A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He grew up around rugby. Went to one of those Irish schools that turns out national team players. Played a bit himself. And the question is basically, what happens to the body after an international match, the hours and days of recovery, and then the long arc? What does the post-career landscape actually look like for these athletes? Are we talking lifelong joint and back problems, or has sports medicine actually moved the needle on that?
There is a study from 2024 in the British Journal of Sports Medicine that looked at exactly the post-match pain question. They tracked 34 professional rugby union players for 120 hours after a match, measuring creatine kinase levels, which is the standard blood marker for muscle damage, plus subjective pain scores across multiple body regions. The creatine kinase levels peaked at about 1,400 units per liter roughly 36 hours post-match. For context, a normal resting adult is below 200. That is not a typo.
They are basically marinating in their own muscle breakdown products for 2 days.
That's exactly what's happening. And the subjective pain scores. They used a 0 to 10 scale across 8 body regions, peaked at the 24 to 48 hour mark, with the highest scores consistently in the lower back, the cervical spine, and the knees. The mean score in those regions was around 6 out of 10, which is moderate to severe pain, and that's in trained professionals who are conditioned to underreport discomfort.
6 out of 10, and these are guys who would describe a broken finger as a bit annoying.
And here's the part that really gets me. The study found that despite all the ice baths, the compression garments, the nutrition protocols, the active recovery sessions, the pain scores didn't return to baseline for a full 96 hours in most players. And for some, it stretched to 120. So if you're playing a Saturday international, you are genuinely not physically recovered until Wednesday or Thursday, and then the next match cycle starts.
Which means if you're in a tournament structure, Six Nations, World Cup pool stages, you're essentially never fully recovered after the first match.
You're playing with what the researchers called residual neuromuscular fatigue that accumulates across the tournament. There was a meta-analysis in 2023 that looked at injury rates across World Cup tournaments and found that the injury incidence in the pool stage is about 68 injuries per 1,000 player hours. In the knockout rounds, it jumps to 91 per 1,000 player hours. That's a 33% increase, and the authors attributed it largely to incomplete recovery between matches.
The body's degradation is cumulative, and the tournament structure basically guarantees you'll be running at a deficit by the semifinals. That's grim.
And this is where rugby union's relationship with padding gets interesting. The prompt mentioned the comparison to American football, and people often assume rugby is somehow more dangerous because there's less protective equipment. But the injury profiles are actually quite different, and the lack of padding changes the physics in ways that are not intuitive.
Walk me through that.
In American football, the helmet and shoulder pads create what biomechanists call a weaponization effect. You lead with your head because the helmet gives you a false sense of security. The collisions involve higher peak forces because players launch themselves. In rugby union, the tackle laws require you to wrap your arms and attempt to bring the player to ground. You can't just launch yourself as a projectile. The tackle height has also been progressively lowered. World Rugby reduced the legal tackle height to below the sternum in community rugby a few years ago, and there's active discussion about bringing that to the professional game.
I remember the trial in France. They moved it to the waist, and there was an absolute uproar.
But the data from the French trial, which ran across their community leagues, showed a 63% reduction in head-on-head contacts and a 27% reduction in all head injury assessments. The tackle height laws are working. The problem is that what you gain in reduced catastrophic head and neck injuries, you may be trading off for different kinds of lower body trauma.
Because now everyone's tackling lower, so the collision point is knees and hips instead of chest and shoulders.
And that brings me to the post-career landscape, which is the second half of the prompt. There was a landmark study published in Sports Medicine in 2025. Researchers out of the University of Bath and the Rugby Players Association tracked over 200 retired professional rugby union players from the English Premiership. The findings were not subtle. 72% reported chronic musculoskeletal pain that interfered with daily activities. 58% had diagnosed osteoarthritis in at least one joint. The mean age of the cohort was 43.
43 years old and 58% already have osteoarthritis. That's staggering.
The knee was the most commonly affected joint, followed by the lumbar spine, then the hip. And the hip findings are particularly interesting because there's a specific pattern in retired rugby players. It's not just general wear and tear, it's CAM-type femoral acetabular impingement, which is a bony overgrowth on the femoral head that develops from repetitive rotational loading during adolescence and early adulthood. Basically, the kicking and the scrummaging and the directional change create a structural deformation that then grinds away the cartilage over a career.
The damage isn't just the collisions. It's the sport literally reshaping the skeleton in ways that guarantee arthritis later.
And the spinal data is just as concerning. The Bath study found that 41% of retired players had degenerative disc disease at multiple levels, with the highest prevalence at L4, L5, and L5S1. Those are the segments that bear the most load in scrum engagement. A scrum can generate up to 16,000 newtons of force across the front row. That's roughly the weight of a small car concentrated through 8 necks and spines.
I've seen those force plate studies. It's absurd. The front row is basically a controlled car crash every time the packs engage.
They do it repeatedly, not just in matches, but in training. The cumulative loading is enormous. But here's where I want to push back against a narrative I think is incomplete. The prompt asks whether there's been significant improvement in the post-career landscape. And the answer is mixed in a way that I find more interesting than a simple yes or no. On one hand, the injury surveillance and management during active careers has improved dramatically. The Premiership and the United Rugby Championship now have mandatory baseline neurocognitive testing, independent matchday doctors who can overrule coaches on head injury assessments, and GPS load monitoring and training to track total weekly running volume and collision count. Players are being managed in season far more carefully than they were even 10 years ago.
That's the during career picture. What about after?
That's where it gets patchy. The Rugby Players Association in England has a dedicated transition program and a health fund that covers joint replacements for retired players. But it's a charity-funded model, not a league-funded entitlement. In France, the Ligue Nationale de Rugby has a more comprehensive post-career medical surveillance program that tracks players for 10 years after retirement. In the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, the post-career support is much more fragmented. There's no unified system.
It depends on which country you happen to sign your contract in.
And there's a class dimension to this, too. The international players, the top-tier names, have access to private medical care. They have savings. They have post-career opportunities in coaching or media. The squad players, the ones who spent their careers in the second tier or as fringe professionals, often retire with the same joints but without the financial cushion. A study out of New Zealand in 2022 found that retired provincial-level players, not all blacks, just provincial, had significantly worse mental health outcomes and higher rates of chronic pain than the general population, and the authors linked it directly to lack of access to ongoing medical care.
That tracks with what I've read about the Championship in England. Players who are professional but on £30,000 contracts, playing the same physical sport, retiring at 32 with two dodgy knees and no real medical support.
And there's a cultural factor too. Rugby has a long history of what the Bath researchers called pain normalization, the idea that playing through pain is not just expected, but valorized. You don't report the shoulder that's been aching for 6 weeks because that's just rugby. And that culture means that many players don't engage with medical support until the problem is severe, by which point the damage is often irreversible.
The stoicism is baked into the sport's identity. Rugby is a thug's game played by gentlemen. The whole mythology revolves around absorbing punishment without complaint.
And that mythology has real downstream consequences. There was a qualitative study, interviews with retired players, published in 2023 that I found really striking. The researchers talked to 25 former professionals about their injury experiences, and a theme that kept coming up was what they called the silent contract. Players described an unspoken understanding that the club would take care of them during their career, but after retirement, they were on their own. Quote from one participant, "You're a commodity, and once you're used up, the phone stops ringing." That's a direct quote from the study.
That's brutal. And it's the exact dynamic you see in a lot of high physical capital professions. The body is the asset, and once it depreciates, the industry moves on.
This is where I think the concussion discourse has actually had a complicated effect. On one hand, the increased attention on brain injury has been absolutely necessary and has driven important rule changes. On the other hand, it has somewhat overshadowed the musculoskeletal long-term outcomes. Everyone talks about CTE now, which is important, but the day-to-day reality for most retired players is not cognitive decline. It's being unable to get out of bed without pain at age 45.
The concussion conversation has captured the public imagination because it's dramatic and it's terrifying. But the more mundane reality is the grinding orthopedic toll.
Let me give you some numbers on that. The Bath study found that 31% of retired players had undergone at least one joint surgery since retirement. The most common was knee arthroscopy, followed by hip replacement. The average age of first hip replacement in that cohort was 51. The general population average is around 67. These guys are getting new hips a decade and a half early.
A hip replacement isn't a one-and-done fix. Those implants have a lifespan. If you get one at 51, you're likely looking at a revision surgery in your 70s, which is a much more complex procedure.
The revision rate for total hip arthroplasty in patients under 55 is about 15 to 20% at 15 years. So you're trading one problem for a future problem, and that's if the surgery goes well.
To answer the prompt's core question directly, yes, most players are in a world of pain in the days after a match, quantified as moderate to severe for up to 4 days. And yes, most carry lifelong injuries, with well over half of retired professionals having diagnosed osteoarthritis by their early 40s. And the improvement picture is real, but uneven, concentrated in active career management, while post-career support remains inconsistent and often inadequate.
That's a fair summary. But I want to add one more dimension that I think is under-discussed, which is that rugby union's injury profile has actually shifted over the past 2 decades in a specific way that relates to professionalism itself. When rugby union went professional in 1995, the players got bigger, faster, and stronger very quickly. In the amateur era, you had players who looked like normal athletic men. Within 10 years of professionalism, the average international forward was carrying 15 to 20 kilograms more lean mass. The collision forces increased proportionally, but the rules and the medical infrastructure lagged behind by about a decade. So there was this window, roughly 1995 to 2010, where players were exposed to forces that the sport hadn't yet adapted to manage.
The guinea pig generation.
And those are the players now in their 40s and 50s who are presenting with the most severe long-term outcomes. The question is whether the current generation, the ones who've benefited from the rule, changes, the load management, the improved surgical techniques, will have better outcomes in 20 years. We don't know yet because the data doesn't exist.
That's the frustrating thing about longitudinal research. You have to wait for people to age.
There is some reason for cautious optimism, though. The injury surveillance data from the professional leagues shows that the overall injury rate has been stable or slightly declining over the past decade, despite the players continuing to get more powerful. The rate of anterior cruciate ligament injuries, which used to be a career ender, has actually dropped by about 40% since 2015 in the top leagues, largely due to improved neuromuscular training programs and earlier identification of at-risk movement patterns.
I didn't know the ACL numbers had improved that much. That's significant.
And the surgical repair techniques have improved in parallel. ACL reconstruction used to involve harvesting a patellar tendon graft, which created its own long-term problems. Now the preferred technique in elite athletes is often an internal brace augmentation, which uses a synthetic ligament to reinforce the repair and allows for much earlier mobilization. The rehabilitation timelines have shortened from 9 to 12 months down to 6 to 8 in some cases.
The acute injury management has advanced. The question is whether that translates into fewer arthritic knees at 50.
The honest answer is, we don't know yet. The internal brace technique has only been in widespread use for about 8 to 10 years. We need another decade of follow-up before we can say whether it reduces post-traumatic osteoarthritis. There's a theoretical basis for thinking it might. Better stability during healing, less graft laxity over time. But theory and long-term outcomes are different things.
That's the thing about sports medicine that always strikes me. The evidence base is perpetually 10 years behind the practice, because you have to wait for the outcomes to manifest.
And rugby has an additional complication, which is that the sport is played in so many different contexts. The injury profile of a professional playing in the URC on a good pitch with full medical support is very different from a semi-professional playing in the Romanian second division on a muddy field with a physio who's also the assistant coach. The research tends to focus on the elite level because that's where the data collection infrastructure exists, but most rugby players are not elite.
The prompt mentioned Daniel's own school rugby experience. That's the vast majority of players. They're not internationals. They're kids and teenagers and club players.
The youth injury data is actually a separate and concerning picture. There was a study in the British Journal of Sports Medicine in 2024 that looked at injury patterns in schoolboy rugby in Ireland specifically, which is relevant given the prompt's context. They found that the injury rate in schools rugby was about 47 injuries per 1,000 player hours, which is comparable to the adult amateur game. The most common injuries were concussions, followed by ankle sprains, followed by shoulder dislocations. And the shoulder dislocations in adolescents are particularly problematic because the recurrence rate is extremely high, up to 80% in some series, and each recurrence further damages the labrum and the bone stock.
I've heard orthopedic surgeons say that a 15-year-old with a first-time shoulder dislocation should essentially be treated as a surgical case now because the non-operative recurrence rate is so high. But that's a big surgery to put a teenager through.
The current consensus is shifting towards something called a ladder jet procedure for young contact athletes with significant bone loss, which involves transferring a piece of the coracoid process to reinforce the front of the glenoid. It's effective, but it's not trivial, and you're making a permanent structural change to a developing skeleton. There's a real ethical question about how aggressively to surgically manage adolescent sports injuries.
The silent contract starting at 15.
And the schools. Rugby environment can be particularly intense. In Ireland, in South Africa, in New Zealand, in parts of England, schools rugby is a serious business. There are scholarships, there are reputations, there's pressure to play through injury that can be even more intense than the professional environment, because teenagers don't have the autonomy to say no.
That's a whole other dimension of this. The pipeline starts young, and the incentives to ignore pain start young too.
Let me bring in something from the research that I think ties a lot of this together. There's a concept in injury epidemiology called load management, the idea that most non-contact injuries occur when the training load exceeds the tissue's capacity to adapt. In rugby, you have both contact and non-contact injuries, but the principle still applies. The problem is that the professional calendar has become increasingly congested. A typical international player now might play 30 to 35 matches per year across club and country, plus preseason, plus training. The World Rugby Regulation says there should be a minimum of 5 days between matches for player welfare, but in practice, the calendar often forces shorter turnarounds during tournament windows.
That's the structural tension. The commercial incentives push toward more matches, more tournaments, more broadcast revenue, while the medical evidence pushes toward fewer matches and longer recovery.
It's the classic conflict between the business model and the biological model. The biological model doesn't care about broadcast deals.
What's the most interesting open question in this space right now? If you had to pick one thing that researchers are uncertain about,
I think it's the question of individual susceptibility. Why do two players with similar exposure profiles, same position, same number of matches, same training load, have completely different long-term outcomes? One retires at 35 with minimal issues, the other needs a hip replacement at 48. There's something going on at the genetic or epigenetic level that we don't understand yet. There's some preliminary work on collagen gene variants, the COL5A1 gene in particular, that might predispose certain individuals to tendon and ligament injuries, but it's very early stage.
We might eventually get to a point where young players are genetically screened for injury risk.
It's possible, and that opens up a whole ethical can of worms that I'm not sure the sport is ready for. Do you tell a 15-year-old, your genetic profile suggests you're at elevated risk for early-onset osteoarthritis if you play rugby? What do they do with that information?
They ignore it and play anyway, because they're 15 and invincible.
But the question is whether the system that benefits from their labor has an obligation to inform them and to provide long-term support if the risk materializes.
That brings us back to the post-career support question. What's the best model that currently exists?
The French system is probably the closest to what you'd want. Every professional player in the top 14 in Pro D2 is enrolled in a long-term health surveillance program that continues for 10 years post-retirement. It includes annual medical assessments, access to specialist consultations, and coverage for surgeries related to career injuries. It's funded by the league and the players' union jointly. The English system, as I mentioned, is more charity-dependent. The Southern Hemisphere is a patchwork.
The Irish system.
The IRFU has a player welfare program that's well-regarded. It includes career transition support, mental health services, and medical coverage for a period after retirement. But it's not as comprehensive as the French model in terms of long-term orthopedic surveillance. And it's worth noting that all of these programs are relatively new. They've really only been in place for the past 10 to 15 years. The generation that's currently in their 50s and 60s largely missed out.
That's the generation that played in the early professional era, when the forces escalated, but the protections hadn't caught up.
They're the ones showing up in the studies with the worst outcomes.
If you're a current professional in your mid-20s, looking at all this data, what should you actually be doing? Beyond the team protocols, beyond the mandatory stuff, what's the evidence-based self-preservation strategy?
The evidence points to a few things. There's a growing body of research on sleep and injury risk in contact sports. A study of professional rugby players in Super Rugby found that those who averaged less than 7 hours of sleep per night had a nearly twofold increase in injury risk over the season. Sleep is when tissue repair happens, when growth hormone is released, when inflammation is modulated. It's the most underrated recovery tool.
Probably the hardest to optimize when you're traveling across time zones for matches.
The second thing is load monitoring. The GPS data that teams collect now can predict injury risk with reasonable accuracy. If you see a spike in acute load relative to chronic load, the injury risk goes up. Players who are proactive about communicating fatigue to the coaching staff, rather than toughing it out, tend to have better long-term outcomes. But that requires a culture where that communication is rewarded, not penalized.
Which goes back to the pain normalization problem.
And the third thing is what happens in the off-season. There's evidence that players who use the off-season to deload reduce training volume, address nagging injuries, let the body reset, have lower injury rates in the subsequent season compared to those who train through. But the pressure to maintain conditioning year-round works against that.
The body needs a true off-switch, and the professional environment doesn't really allow for one.
It doesn't, and that's where the structural reform conversation needs to go. The rule changes around tackle height are important, the concussion protocols are important, but the calendar congestion might be the single biggest modifiable risk factor for both acute injury and long-term degeneration.
That's the one that's hardest to change because it's where the money is.
Every additional match is additional revenue. Reducing the calendar means reducing income, and player welfare doesn't show up on the balance sheet until years later, when the players are someone else's problem.
The externalized cost problem applied to human bodies.
The clubs and the leagues capture the benefit during the player's career, and the player bears the cost afterward. It's a classic market failure.
Where does this leave us on the prompt's question about improvement? It sounds like the honest answer is yes, there's been significant improvement in acute injury management and in awareness monitoring during careers, but the structural problems, calendar congestion, inconsistent post-career support, the pain normalization culture, remain largely unsolved.
I think that's right. And I'd add that the improvement has been unevenly distributed. The top-tier internationals are better protected than ever. The fringe professionals and the semi-professionals are not much better off than they were 20 years ago, and in some ways they're worse off because the physical demands have increased without a corresponding increase in support.
The gap between the protected and the unprotected has widened.
And that's a story you see across a lot of professional sports. But it's particularly stark in rugby because the physical toll is so high and the career earnings for non-elite players are relatively modest. The average premiership career is about 7 years and the median salary is around £120,000. That's good money, but it's not retire at 32 and never work again. Money, especially if you're facing significant medical costs.
Your earning potential in your post-rugby career is potentially limited by the physical damage you've accumulated.
If you can't stand for long periods, can't lift, can't do physical work, your employment options are constrained. That's why the career transition support is so critical, and it's why the French model of ongoing medical surveillance matters. It's not just about treating pain, it's about maintaining functional capacity for a second career.
The summary for the prompt is, yes, the hours and days after an international match involve genuine physiological distress that takes 4 to 5 days to resolve. Yes, the majority of retired professionals carry significant musculoskeletal damage, with osteoarthritis rates above 50% by the early 40s. The improvement picture is real in specific areas, ACL management, concussion protocols, load monitoring, but the systemic issues around post-career support and calendar congestion are far from solved, and the culture of playing through pain remains a deep-rooted challenge.
That's a fair and comprehensive answer. And I'd add the note of uncertainty about the current generation. We don't know if the interventions of the past decade will change the long-term outcomes because the data won't exist for another 10 to 15 years.
Which is both hopeful and unsettling.
That's sports medicine in a nutshell.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, brine shrimp in the Caspian Basin were observed orienting themselves using light reflected off salt flats, effectively navigating by polarized glare in an environment where the horizon dissolves into white nothingness. Migratory flamingos learned to track the same polarized signals to locate the brine shrimp colonies, creating a predator-prey relationship mediated entirely by optics.
The flamingos cracked the shrimp's navigation system.
Nature's signal intelligence.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. Find more at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.